is 9 a.m. on June 12th, 2013, and you're listening to Good Morning Atlanta, sponsored by World Trade Center Atlanta on Business Radio X, a proud 2013 member of Central Atlanta Progress. Learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at atlantadowntown.com. I'm Dana Barrett. And usually at this point in the show, my partner Elizabeth Gordon chimes in and says, I always like to make fun of her. And I'm Elizabeth Gordon, but she's not here. So hopefully she'll breeze in a few minutes. If not, it's okay because I have a wonderful guest in the studio today. The mortgage guy, Joe Trovato, joining me. Hi, Joe.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well. It's great to be here with you.
Well, thanks for being here. Sometimes we have a full house in here. All the chairs are full. But today, Joe, it's just you and me.
You cleared it out for me.
Yeah. Well, you're a VIP. I wanted to make sure
that,
you know, you got all the attention that you deserve.
Absolutely. Got a lot to talk about.
A lot to talk about. Well, you know, it's interesting, and we're going to get to this, of course, but, you know, there's not a person, I don't think, whether you own or rent, that isn't interested in what's happening in the real estate market, because it affects everybody. It does affect rental prices, even if you're not buying, right?
Oh, absolutely does.
Yeah. So we're going to get to all of that. And plus, it's always just interesting. I think people like looking at houses. You know, the other day I was out on the way home from, I don't know, a store or whatever. I was driving with my boyfriend, and we just decided to drive through a neighborhood and see what the houses look like, you know. And I think people – and then there was actually a estate sale going on. We were kind of in this back sort of neighborhood of really big fancy homes in Brookhaven. And so we pulled into this estate sale more because we just wanted to see what the inside of the house looked like. We didn't really want to buy anything.
Right.
We were just curious, you know. And I think a lot of people feel that way.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why open houses on the weekends are so popular, because people just want to see what's going on and how people decorate and how the houses are situated and engineered and, you know, just what the aesthetics are. And that'll change from neighborhood to neighborhood and sometimes even within the neighborhoods. But, you know, we live in our houses, so we're always interested to see, you know, what other people live in.
Right. Yeah. It's like looking into somebody else's window. And then the other thing, too, I find, you know, certainly I know when I was younger, part of it is also, well, there's two things about it. Part of it is dreaming. You know, it's sort of fantasizing. You go into the big, fancy million-dollar home that you probably can't afford because you just want to see, and maybe someday I could afford this. You know, this I would love to have, you know, 17 bathrooms and a, you know, golden toilet seat or whatever, you know.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I know a good friend of mine, anytime she needed, she was a self-employed person. Anytime she needed motivation, that's what she would do. She would go and look at all the big fancy houses, and that would kind of readjust her focus to get back on track to what her goals were.
Yeah.
And just from the dreaming aspect. And, you know, I mean, that's what people, when people walk into a home and, you know, I could see it in their eyes, it's like a wow factor. Wow.
Right.
I can really see myself living here.
Yeah.
And that's what people buy. They feel when they walk into a home, they know within like 2 to 3 minutes whether or not they're ever going to step foot back in that house.
It's true. I mean, as we both – so we both know Tara, of course, who's
right.
A real estate agent, and we're now taking her name in vain. But, you know, we went around with Tara, and we walked into some houses, and I basically – as soon as I walked in the door, I was ready to walk back out. I mean, I didn't even have to look at the rest of the house. I just walked in. It didn't feel right. I'm like, this isn't it. No. Like, even if the listing looked like it was good, as soon as you walked in, you got a sense, and you were like, forget it. And the reverse, also obviously true. You walk in, and you're like, oh – okay.
Yeah.
I could see this. This could work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always interesting to talk about real estate, and then you add to that, how do I pay for it? And that's where Joe, the mortgage guy, comes in. So we're going to get to that. But first, let's hit the headlines a little bit. I'm going to be a little more serious today, only on one story than I usually am, only because, you know, sometimes I tend to pick the stories to talk about that are just – little guy stories. They're funny or they're interesting or whatever. But, you know, sometimes we got to talk about the big companies and what's happening with stock prices and whatever. So I just want to mention that Coca-Cola Enterprises is warning of a rocky second quarter for investors. So you don't ever think of Coke as struggling, because, I mean, I drink a lot of Diet Coke. I think I alone probably keep that company in business.
I mean, yeah, they have, I don't know, 2,000 brands across the world. And how could they ever struggle? I mean, every single bottle of water I think I drink is actually a Coca-Cola product.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Well, what they're saying is that throughout 2012 and so far this year, they faced some challenging operating conditions, including persistent underlying macroeconomic weakness, significant, this is what they're saying, literally headwinds from poor weather, the prolonged impact of sharp excise tax increase in France, of all places, and a dynamic competitive environment in Great Britain. So, you know, you have to think about this. Coca-Cola is not just here. So they're dealing with the world economy.
Right.
They're dealing with, you know, weather tragedies all over the world. I mean, everything like that affects their business. And also, I think, I don't know if everyone knows, but Coca-Cola is separated. So Enterprises is different than regular Coke. And I think Coca-Cola, I think, and I could get this wrong, someone can correct me on this, but I think Coca-Cola Enterprises is more the operational side in terms of getting the product out. But I could be wrong about that. I think they're the ones that deliver the product. So they, because the company split into multiple segments.
Right. They have multiple subsidiaries around the world because
right.
just to handle that big of a company, I mean, they truly are a global company.
Right.
And they have other companies set up throughout the world where, you know, they may make the syrups in one place and then hit it with the carbonation in another
somewhere else,
place.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, we like to talk about Coke just because they're based here and we're all loyal to Coke because otherwise we probably wouldn't have Atlanta. Anyway, interesting to note that in the first quarter, their profit fell, get this, 44% to $61 million. And in 2012, the profit was down 9.6%. So we'll see what happens. Hopefully it's not, hopefully it's just a little glitch in the road for Coke and everything will be fine. Because I can't imagine the world without Coke. That doesn't even make sense, right? It's not going to happen, obviously. But I'm just, you don't want to see them struggle because it's Coke.
Right.
I don't know.
And, you know, so drink a lot of Diet Coke and
right.
you'll
go
be
out and get a Coke. I don't necessarily need to have all their executives owning gold toilet seats. Why that's my like thing of the day, I couldn't tell you. However, I don't want Coke to have any problems because I like my Diet Coke and I would be lost without it, Joe. All right, moving on. I am a shopper.
No kidding.
I know. Isn't that shocking? I like to shop and I like Atlanta to do well. And Buckhead, again, talking about real estate, you know, you always talk about what's happening in these different neighborhoods. You know, when I moved to Atlanta, Buckhead was thriving. I mean, Buckhead was, it was the late 80s and, you know, Buckhead was the place to be for young people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was the place to live. It was where the bars were. It was happening. It was hot. It was awesome, you know. And then little by little, it started to fall apart. I kind of stopped going because I got married and had a baby and all that business.
I think it's generational, you know. I mean, I moved here in 93 and it was just jumping.
Yeah.
And that's where you wanted to be. But as that generation got older, you know, we moved out to the suburbs.
Right. Exactly. And then what sort of came in wasn't so good. It was a little riffraffy. And then there was some crime there and there were all kinds of problems. And so they basically just came in with a giant bulldozer and like tore down Buckhead is really what happened. And then we were talking about timing before we got on the air. And then in a, you know, sort of just a bad luck timing sort of thing, the economy collapsed. So basically Buckhead for the last, 5 years has just been a giant hole in the ground.
Right. It's been the big dig in Atlanta.
The big dig. Cranes and walls up and nothing happening.
Right.
Cranes just sitting there and not moving. I always wondered about that. Don't the cranes get rusty if they just sit there, John?
Yeah, they got good paint.
Ayo. They're all right. All of that to say, we keep reporting stories over the last year. We've been reporting stories all the time about, the cranes are moving again. Oh, Buckhead is coming back. Oh, they're starting. So I have another story along that line, which is that a store called Fixtures Living is coming to Buckhead. It is a California-based store, and it's going into the Lenox Marketplace Shopping Center. That's the one that has the Target and the Dick's Sporting Goods, and I think there's like an LA Fitness in there and Publix. And there's a big empty space. I think there used to be a Filene's basement.
Oh, Filene's.
Yeah, the bookstore is now the Container Store.
Okay.
So just keeping you up on retail. Not like I would know anything about that. Not that I don't shop at all these places. But anyway, there's still a big empty space in there. And this Fixtures Living store is coming in there. It'll be interesting because this is a high-end kitchen, bath, outdoor, and lifestyle appliances store.
Mm-hmm.
So people like you are going to love this. This is like a store for when your wife or your girlfriend, I'm being so sexist right now, I can't even stand myself, wants to buy something for the house. You're going to be like, let's go to this place because they're going to have all the cool high-end stuff.
Right. Absolutely.
And you know, I think you and I talked about this the first time we met. If you're going to buy a gadget, you want the coolest one with the best stuff, right?
Yeah, that's why people wait online for the iPhone.
Yeah, right.
Right. It's just you want the coolest thing right now.
Yeah. So if you're needing to buy a new stove, you want the coolest one. Now, you don't always end up getting it because you're like, well, I can't spend, you know, $18,000 for a stove because that's ridiculous. But you still want it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's still cool to see. And the thing is, I think it's strategically speaking, I think it's, the timing is right for that type of store in this market. You know, getting back to real estate, and we'll get to it in a little while. But Atlanta is the number one market, the metro Atlanta area, for renovations.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I think, as you point out, I mean, it is all tied to real estate. One, because the Buckhead area is coming back up. But two, because more people are buying homes again. Whether they're renting or buying, there's more moving going on. There's more movement. So people are going to buy the stuff to put in their new place.
That's right.
Or they're going to renovate.
That's
either
right.
way, mm-hmm. you know. So anyway, that's kind of interesting. And on the same line, there was a Restoration Hardware store in Lenox Mall that closed.
Wow.
And there was still one up in Perimeter. Yeah, I think it's Perimeter somewhere. But the one in Lenox closed. Well, they're planning to reopen a new, what they're calling, flagship store in Buckhead. And that is planned for the former ESPN Zone space.
Cool.
Yeah. So I really have high hopes that Buckhead is going to become a destination. I mean, the goal when they did the big dig was to have it end up being like a Beverly Hills kind of area with very high-end shopping and restaurants and things like that. And I hope that's true. Because it's funny, you know, a girlfriend of mine called me the other day and said, you know, I'm going into Buckhead to meet somebody I don't know and I need a restaurant. Where should I take them? I said, you know what? I don't know. I mean, there are still some things in Buckhead, but it's not like there's a ton. There's sort of really high-end restaurants that have stuck it out, like Capital Grill and things like that.
Antica Posta.
Yeah, there's some that have been there all along and they're good, but you know, there's just nothing that jumped into my head as like the perfect sort of middle of the road place. There's a lot of high-end stuff and there's some, you know, chains, like you can go get a salad somewhere or whatever, but finding that middle of ground. So hopefully as the retail starts to come back, we'll get some good new restaurants and stuff too. All right. Are you a sports guy?
Yes.
Okay. So did you hear this story about Chipper Jones?
No.
All right. So apparently Chipper Jones, and I have two sports stories I'm going to bring up with you.
Was he signed by the Mets?
No.
No? Okay.
At least not according to the story. This is just about a tweet that he did. So apparently, and this, you know, I love when this stuff makes the news because social media is so crazy now. You have to be so careful about everything you say. Well, apparently Chipper Jones had to apologize for a Twitter quote unquote joke that he tweeted last Saturday about Gators, the Rio Grande, and illegals. So this is what he said.
Whoa.
This is the actual tweet. Y'all think if they took all them gators they trap in Florida and Louisiana and put them in the Rio Grande, it would stop the illegals from crossing? ? So, right. Doesn't seem that offensive to me. But you know how people are. So the tweet was retweeted more than 2,000 times.
Whoa.
And became fodder for both social media sites and mainstream news organizations, including USA Today and Fox Sports. On Sunday, then, Jones tweeted an apology, and this is what he said. I realized that my tweet, meaning yesterday, was offensive and distasteful. An attempt at humor was a terrible mistake. Please accept my heartfelt apology. Okay, people, can we please stop being so freaking sensitive?
I think that it maybe made the news because of who tweeted it.
Exactly.
If I tweeted it, nobody really knows me.
No, they wouldn't care.
It would be like, who's this guy? What?
One guy wouldn't get a mortgage from you from that tweet.
Right.
Nobody else would care.
Right.
Like that one guy.
Right.
Or nobody would read it at all because that's the other side of Twitter. Like how much of that tweeting that's going on is just going out into thin air and nobody ever reads it?
Probably 90% of it.
Exactly.
The other thing too is, you know, it is a topic of the day. It is a talking point. I mean, we do have to do something about our borders and immigration. I mean, it's a huge topic in our country.
Right. And it's very divisive.
And people are talking about it.
Yeah. So I just thought it was kind of funny because it was sort of harmless. And it doesn't even really say what his opinion is on the topic.
Right.
It's just,
do they not have gators in the Rio Grande?
I don't know. He's just making a crack, you know, and let the guy. I mean, holy crap. Anyway, speaking of doing stupid things, did you see the story about Ocho Cinco and the and the famous butt slap heard around the world? Not really.
Not really.
All right. Here's the story. So I was watching the news. I guess it was yesterday. And, you know, Ocho Cinco, the football player, right?
Yeah.
So he apparently
changed his name. That's a football player who changed his name to like 85
Chad,
in Spanish. It's
right.
Ocho Cinco.
Right. It's Chad Ocho Cinco, whatever his real last name is. Who
really
knows?
Cool.
Well, but apparently about a year or so ago, and I don't follow football, so I didn't know this, and I'm not even sure how I had heard of him in the past, but I guess because of his name change and whatever, I knew who he was. But apparently he had gotten arrested for domestic abuse, domestic violence, right, about a year or so ago, mm-hmm, with his wife. He'd only been married for 30, 40 days or something like that, and there was an incident, and he was convicted, I guess, and given probation.
Okay.
And they got divorced, so moving on. Well, apparently he broke his probation, and so I don't know what he did, but he did something that was a violation of his probation, and so he had an attorney, and they were in court working a plea deal. The plea deal had completely been written up and approved ahead of time by the judge. So this was a formality, him showing up in court with his lawyer to have the stamp put on the plea deal. Now, this judge, I'm going to just tell you the story first, and then I'm going to tell you my opinion, because I'm really dying to like tell you my opinion. But anyway, so she says to him, she looks very stern, and she says to him, "You really need to thank your lawyer because he did an excellent job for you." So Chad, getting him out of a 30-day jail sentence he should have had to pay for his breaking of this of this probation. So Chad Ochocinco turns to the attorney, like slightly turns towards him, and they have the whole thing on camera, so this is not like just hearsay. And he pats the lawyer on the butt. And the judge gets pissed. She's like, "This is not a joke, sir. Are you taking this seriously?" She gets really pissed, and he's like, "No, I'm not. I wasn't trying to be funny." And but everyone in the courtroom had laughed when he did it. So, you know, she's like, "Everyone in the courtroom is laughing," and he's like, "I didn't mean it as a joke." And the lawyer apologized and whatever. She put him in jail for 30 days.
Whoa. Did
not accept the plea agreement. But I thought it was an interesting story because the news media, the way they reported the story was to say, well, they showed the clip, so that allows you to judge for yourself, right? And but what they really said was, "Oh, that'll teach you not to mess with a judge."
Yeah, I don't know about that. You know, he's in court in front of the judge because he put his hands on somebody.
Yes.
And now he got a good lawyer and he got a good plea deal, I guess. I don't know the details, but it seems like it was probably a good deal. And then right before the judge approved it, he put his hands on somebody again.
Yeah.
So
good
when
point.
When you look at it logically, I can see the judge's point. Keep your hands to yourself, buddy.
Good point. I didn't think about it that way. That's a good point. I was thinking more, well, first of all, you have to see the clip because she just comes across to me as like a bitch.
Well,
can
maybe
I say
she,
that?
Maybe I don't know. I didn't see the clip, but maybe she didn't like the deal. I mean, she made the comment, "Oh, your lawyer did a good job for you."
Right. It's almost like she had to accept it kind of thing. Like she couldn't really. The thing is, this is the problem I have. So first of all, I agree with you. On the one hand, I think he was just, whether he was trying to be funny or not, I mean, this is not a guy who was like brought up in corporate America. And like he was gotten to sports, I'm sure, because he was ultra talented at an early age. They feel very, entitled, like they can do whatever they want, you know. So, he probably didn't receive good coaching or training in terms of being a professional adult.
You know, and it's just a reflex, too, because he was brought up in the locker room. God bless him. He's talented. And you know, that's the old pat on the butt.
That's what – and she told
that's
him to thank his lawyer. So that's what he did.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when she got on him about it, he wasn't arrogant. He was apologetic. I mean, he was sort of like, "Oh, no, I didn't mean that. Sorry." You know, I mean, he was sort of like not aggressive about it. However, so there's two sides to it. One, like, yes, he shouldn't have done that. It was not the right thing to do. However, I don't really think it should have earned him 30 days in jail. You know, her whole thing was, "You're not taking this whole thing seriously." I don't know if that's true or not. On the other hand, she came across, and it's interesting too, because I've been doing a lot of reading lately about gender bias and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're all gender biased, not just men biased against women, but women are biased against women. We can't help it.
Right.
And I immediately thought, wow, she seems like a bitch. You know, whereas if a guy had done it, I might have had a different attitude.
Right.
Which is interesting because I immediately thought like she's a power hungry. Like she didn't like anybody sort of making a joke of her courtroom. That was the thing.
You know, she's still the judge, you know, and good, bad, or indifferent, male, female, whatever walk of life you are, you're the judge. It that office and that seat deserves respect. And, you know, they got the old gavel thing, right? Order in the court.
Yeah. Though it seemed to me, and again, like I don't know enough about, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know enough about what options they do have.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like to me she should have charged him with contempt of court and still accepted the plea agreement and just given him a new charge because.
Well, that's where I would agree with you. You know, how do you make the leap from, you know, I got a plea deal that I'm about to sign off on to, oh, you had a gesture that I didn't like.
Right.
Sounds a little bit discriminatory.
Right.
So the only thing that I could come up with is that maybe she made a judgment. I mean, she's a judge, and said, look, this guy needs to keep his hands to himself, which I personally don't think was such a big deal that he slapped his lawyer on the butt.
I don't either. And I don't, the lawyer didn't,
you know,
either.
To,
I mean, nobody
30
was
30 days in jail.
Right.
So
anyway, interesting. Nobody was offended except her, I think, but it is what it is. And that's what happened. So I just,
well,
was...
I wonder what her reaction would have been if the lawyer was female.
Oh, that wouldn't have been, or what if the client was female?
Right.
You know, I mean, that can happen. Yeah. Women get arrested for domestic violence too, right?
Yeah.
So what if the client had been female and she slapped her male attorney on the butt? Female attorney on the butt? I don't know.
I don't know.
Or what if she hugged him? Or what if she just, like, punched him on the shoulder? You know, it just brings up a whole lot of questions. Was it because it was a butt slap? Like, what if he had just punched him on the shoulder, like a little, like, or fist bumped him or something?
I mean, I would agree. Those are all, you could, those are all the same gestures. I mean, maybe she felt that he was making a mockery of her court.
Right.
And that was it. Now you're going to jail, buddy.
Right.
That stinks for him. That's,
yeah,
too bad.
Yeah. And also, you know, because of this whole thing, he didn't play ball at all last year. So his career is sort of over, I think, too. Although you never know. I mean, sometimes they are able to come back from stuff like that.
You know, a year off, maybe, you know, saves his body a little bit. He can come back. And I hope to see him again. I really thought he was a great player. I really liked him.
I mean, obviously, the whole other side of it is that the domestic abuse situation is not good. We don't want that as a role model for our kids and all that stuff.
Absolutely not.
But
absolutely not. I have daughters, and absolutely not. Keep your hands to yourself.
Yeah, totally. All right, moving on. We, you know, I talked about the Buckhead stores and this stuff. So I always like to talk about, you know, we talk about the bad and the good happening here when there are layoffs. And one of the nice things is that Metro Atlanta right now has a pretty good forecast for hiring. You know, the economy is still, I mean, nobody's, I think, really willing to go out on a limb and say, like, we're in recovery, because, yeah, it still seems a little sluggish. I think there's a lot happening. Cranes are moving. Real estate sales are coming back. But I think people are almost like a little bit afraid to just say, okay, we're good now. However, it does look like there's going to be some good hiring in Q3. What they're saying is there are, I think, 6% of the companies surveyed will be doing some layoffs, but 22% will be hiring. So more companies looking for people than looking to cut back, which is a good thing.
Great.
And that's actually true nationwide as well.
You know, what we're seeing in real estate, too, is that some of the commercial space is starting to get occupied, which is always a good sign. Usually you look at, you know, what commercial space is doing, and once that inventory starts getting used up, that's usually a sign that the market's coming back, because businesses need a place to set up.
To operate, yeah, absolutely.
Operate out of. You know, and the other thing, too, is Atlanta's still a destination place for companies to move into. So
yeah,
we still have a good majority of companies moving in. State Farm just took a bunch of space in Dunwoody. They're going to hire a bunch of people. And, you know, there's just lots of stories of companies still moving here, which has really been a trend for Atlanta for, you know, many, many years.
Yeah, there were probably four or five stories I could have chosen to bring in this morning about companies bringing jobs here.
Right.
2,000 jobs from one company, you know, 50 from another, 100 from another. Starts to add up.
Which is all great for real estate.
It's all great for real estate, and it's all great for everybody here who's unemployed and looking for work, you know. Some of these companies will bring people with them, but they're not going to bring everybody.
Right.
So they're going to be looking, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, another topic we that's been in the news a lot and that people are talking a lot about in terms of the country, but also here in Atlanta, is STEM jobs, which is science, technology, engineering, and math, I believe is what that stands for. It's all those sort of techie fields that the U.S., I sort of think, has a reputation of not being up to par in those areas. And there are things about women not getting enough involved in STEM careers and STEM jobs and things like that. So there's a lot of discussion about STEM in general. So I always like to go back to the beginning, first of all, because when people talk in abbreviations like that, acronyms, it drives me crazy. I'm like, what? Huh? Why do they have to give everything an acronym? Why can't they just say, like, science and math? No.
I don't know, because we're moving too fast, and acronyms are always cool.
Yeah, I guess, or super annoying, depending on – maybe that's an age thing for me. I don't know. But anyway, the good news is that Atlanta is actually number 10 in the country for STEM jobs. And this is a study done by the Brookings Institution. So this is the real deal. I mean, this isn't just like, you know, some blog saying this. This is a real study. And it, in part, I think it's because of some of the institutions we have here, Georgia Tech. Yeah, of course. But that's good news. I mean, I think we are slowly becoming a real contender in the technology fields in terms of investment money, in terms of companies being here, in terms of job availability. You know, we're not quite Silicon Valley yet, but I think, you know, we have a lot to offer for people.
Right. There's tons of technology jobs, just up 400. I mean, I've heard it, people call it as, you know, little Silicon Valley or Silicon Valley of the South, or just tons and tons of technology jobs.
And one of the other interesting things about it is that it all comes back to real estate, because once again, the difference, a huge difference between us and Silicon Valley is you can afford to live here.
Right.
You cannot afford to live in Silicon Valley if you're starting out. Even if you're getting a really good tech job salary, a starting salary is still a starting salary. And it's difficult to buy a home in Silicon Valley. The prices are just outrageous. I watch a lot of HGTV, so I know these things.
Well, you know, the affordability factor right now in housing is really through the roof wherever you are in the country. And there's other pockets like Atlanta that are truly a value play as far as affordability. Now, the affordability index is basically a calculation that includes the price of homes, the level of interest rates, and people's medium income.
Right.
So although we're like at 80%, a little less than 80% today, Atlanta still outpaces a lot of other metropolitan areas in the affordability factor. So again, not only is Atlanta drawing businesses, it's drawing people that think, well, I'll just go live in Atlanta because it's a lower cost of living, it's a better value, and I can afford it.
And there's obviously, we talk about all the sort of advantages of Atlanta all the time. So those are certainly a big part of it. You have an airport here that can get you pretty affordably to almost anywhere. You know, the biggest airport in the Southeast for sure. But it's one of the biggest in the country. I don't know. I know it's a big hub.
Yeah, it's either second or third behind Chicago and LAX. I mean, we might be third or fourth.
Pretty big.
Yeah, but we're pretty big.
Yeah, and you can kind of like literally get almost anywhere with without a connection from here, which is pretty cool. And there are more and more attractions here as well. We're getting our big Ferris wheel downtown. Did you know about that?
Yeah, it's cool.
It's kind of interesting. I talked about that the other day because I was sort of like, okay, you go up in a Ferris wheel. When you go up in the London Eye, for example, you're looking at London. And it's got all these like, you know, historic, beautiful buildings and bridges and water. And you go up in a Ferris wheel over Atlanta and I'm not sure what you're looking at. You're looking at the downtown connector and some smog. I don't know.
Well, you can see all the way out to the mountains, which is kind of cool.
And I love Atlanta. I'm not trying to call us out, but I'm calling us out a little bit. And on that note, I have one last story before we really fully dive into this mortgage business. And that is that Atlanta, there's a new list out from, this one comes from TripAdvisor. And it's talking about it's sort of a long list of from the cheapest to the most expensive summer travel destinations, right?
Right, yeah.
Atlanta comes in at number 4 on the cheapest summer travel destination. Would you believe the cheapest is Las Vegas?
Really?
Yeah. With an average cost of $272.94, I think that's per night. And those, they're
Does that include the money in the casino or no?
No. But they're, no. No. Now, Joe, if you could behave yourself, it's cheap, right? And what they include in that is hotel, taxi round trip to the airport, dinner for two, and cocktails for two for one night, right?
Okay.
So Atlanta has a total cost per day, $331.14. Whereas Las Vegas, $272.94. However, you're right. In Las Vegas, you're probably going to see a show and spend some money at the tables, Joe.
the horse room.
Yeah. The South is generally affordable in terms of this list. 5 of the 10 least expensive cities are Miami, Dallas, Atlanta, New Orleans, and Houston. But this is why I brought this story up. Because who wants to come here in the summer?
It's too hot and muggy.
It's hot.
Humid.
So, of course, it's affordable.
No
it's
beach.
Freaking hot. Right. There's no water. There's no, at least Miami, there's a beach. And you can, like, see people in bikinis, and it's like there's something to do there. But, like, why would you? I mean, listen, again, I love Atlanta. Please don't get me wrong, listeners. I love all of you. I love Atlanta. But really? Should this even be on the list as a summer travel destination?
Well, yeah. I mean, we got a lot of cool stuff. We have the aquarium. We have the Braves. Come on. Well, there's a lot of people. You could visit your grandkids.
I mean,
where is Orlando, Florida, Disney World on that list?
I don't have the full list in front of me, but I guarantee you it's one of the more expensive ones. Because right. Orlando, well, you know, I guess if they're not counting the tickets to the attractions, then it might not be too bad.
Right.
But even the hotels there, I think, are pretty pricey.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought it was funny because I was sort of like going, I don't think in my right. Now, granted, I've lived here for over 20 years, so of course I wouldn't come here for a summer break. But I just...
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. You know, I'm originally from New York City, and I lived in New York City, Manhattan, and Brooklyn for 25 years, and I would never go to New York on vacation. Going to New York City, although it is the greatest city in the world, according to a lot of people, I would never go there on vacation. I mean, I'll go with my family and show them around, but vacation to me is not going to New York City because I'm from there. People who aren't from Atlanta probably think, wow, I want to go to the South and check it out. That's really cool. So from their perspective, it might be a really cool destination.
Well, it's funny that you say that because I went to school up in New York State. And so I have a lot of friends that are from the city. And one of my girlfriends would always say to me, like, don't come to New York in the summer. It's so hot here. And I was thinking, like, you don't know hot. That's not hot. Like, so it's a little toasty. You, like, stand next to a building, you're in the shade. Done. Like, it's not
yeah, until the heat from the exhaust of the building, you know, hits you at about 120 degrees.
But people who live in the South are used to spending all their time in air conditioning inside. So, right. Like, we don't care. Like, whatever. I'll be hot for a few minutes, and I'll go in the AC, and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Big deal.
I love the people that want to go to New York and ride on the subway. I'm like, yeah, that ain't me.
You're like, that's not a vacation.
No.
That's a pain in the neck. Yeah, it's kind of funny. But, I just have a hard time thinking of why you'd want to go here.
Oh, we got Stone Mountain. I mean, we got a lot of cool stuff.
It's good that I brought you on for, like, the counterpoint.
Yeah.
It's good because I'm going like, and you're like, okay, but no, it's nice. No, I'm not buying it, Joe, but all right. All right. All right. Let's move on and talk more intense. We've been talking about real estate really the whole show. So we're kind of sneaking it in wherever we can, but let's talk more about mortgages.
Plugging it in.
And, you know, so we're talking all about where to live and why people want to live in certain places and all that stuff. But then it gets down to, and this is interesting because it's the same with car buying. So I really want to buy a new car, right? And so it's all sexy and everything while you're looking at the vehicles and you're thinking about what do I want and what's going to be my personality. And it's the same with homes. What neighborhood really defines me and what kind of person am I? You know, both, I think those buying decisions are similar in that
right.
way.
Sure.
And then you have to start thinking about money.
How am I going to pay for this shiny new car?
Can I afford this? Is this even in my wheelhouse?
Right.
So that's when they call Joe. So, like, first of all, I guess the first question I have, and it's been a while since I've bought something myself. When is the best time for somebody to start talking to you? Is it before they go out looking? Is it while they're looking? Is it after they found the dream home? Like, when is the best time to actually engage their mortgage person?
I mean, that's a really great question. I mean, the first thing you want to do is, you know, like we talked earlier, it's always fun to go and look at the house to see, you know, the type of house or the neighborhood that I want to live in. I mean, that's the fun. That's the emotional part of it.
Right.
But really, once you get past that and you seriously start to consider buying a new home, you really need to talk to a mortgage professional almost immediately because of there's certain things involved. If you're going to need a mortgage to finance your home, there's things involved like how much am I going to really need to put down?
Yeah.
How much is my payment really going to be? What are the taxes? What types of mortgage programs are going to be the best for me for my individual specific financial situation to get me where I want to be in retirement or to get my kids through school or whatever that your goal may be? Really needs to happen in the beginning. Just for that, for your own financial planning standpoint. The second reason why you should talk to somebody immediately is because you don't want to get in a car and go look at a house at $700,000 and find out you can only afford a $200,000 house.
Right. And you fall in love with the one that there's no way.
Right. So then you're setting yourself up to get heartbroken. The other reason is you need to get with a mortgage professional immediately is because in order for a real estate agent to put an offer in on a house, you have to have a qualification letter. If you're using a mortgage, if you're a cash buyer, well, then you need a letter from your bank saying you have enough money to buy the house.
Yeah.
So either way, you need to be having that conversation about the mortgage, you know, pretty much up front, almost immediately.
I think, and I mean, I'm going to just put it out there. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking most people are not cash buyers. Yeah, sure, it happens, but
right.
most people probably not. And it's really a good use of your money, isn't it, to have a mortgage? Because you get a tax write-off, don't you? I mean,
yeah.
it's like even if you could afford to pay cash, you probably want a mortgage.
Well, it's one of the few write-offs we still have today anyway, you know. And basically what happens in a low interest rate market like we're in today, you know, mortgage rates are hovering around 4% on a 30-year fix, a little bit lower, maybe 3.5 on a 15-year fix. That's really cheap money.
Yeah.
So a lot of the thinking is, well, if I can have a mortgage on a house for, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, well, I can take that money, that $200,000 or $300,000, and put it in savings or retirement, and at some point make more on my investment income than the interest on my houses.
Right.
So it's called an arbitration play. And right now, that's, you know,
still a good
model for people that even have the cash to put down. You know, they're utilizing, you know, mortgage financing as a financial strategy or a financial tool. Now, most people need a mortgage.
Right. Need it. It's not even a question of it's a good play. Yeah. It's like, I this is the only way I'm going to buy a house.
Right. So then there's questions like, you know, how much can I put down? How much should I put down? And, you know, qualifications. You know, we're in a little bit of a different market today than we were, you know, just 3, 4, 5 years ago when the guidelines were very different. So you want to be talking to your mortgage professional up front to make sure that you can actually qualify for the loan and get approved and get through closing.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because there was obviously obviously anybody who watches the news even a little bit knows that there was, you know, a huge thing a number of years ago where they were giving mortgages basically to anybody.
Right.
As you said, the qualifications were very low, and they were giving people these balloon plans and then the whole,
toxic mortgages.
Right. And then the whole bottom fell out and banks were in trouble and they went under and people were losing their homes all over the place. It was crazy.
Right.
And that's all gone.
That's right.
So
it's all gone.
So what, you know, with somebody who's looking and they're thinking, I'm going to buy my first home, they're out there, you know, maybe they're in their mid-20s or early 30s or something, and they're looking and they, you know, maybe make a average income, whatever that is. You know, they're not a CEO. They're kind of a regular guy. What do you need to qualify?
Great question. You know, the qualifications today are very much like they were before the whole boom. So it's really not that different. I mean, I have a lot of clients that are coming back to me that we did loans back in, you know, the mid to late 90s, and now they're, you know, maybe buying up or buying down or resizing their house, and they're coming, they're like, wow, what do I need to qualify? And for those folks, it's exactly the same thing they needed, you know, 15 years ago that they need today. It's just that middle zone between like 2001 or 2006, where it kind of got out of control.
Right.
So what you need is, first of all, you need to have verifiable income.
Right.
How do you get paid? How are you going to make money? How do you make money to pay for the loan? You have to qualify for the payment. And typically you need tax returns to show where the money, the earnings are,
right,
pay stubs, W-2s, tax returns. And you have to qualify. I mean, there's a debt-to-income ratio where, you know, you have to be at about less than, you know, 45% of your gross income in debt. So you have 55% of your gross income to basically live on
to pay
after you pay your bills.
Right.
So you need income, you need money to put down. You know, a lot of what got us into trouble was the no down payment loans. So, I mean, back in 2006, here's a scary stat, 36% of all the new mortgages were investment properties.
Wow.
Out of those investment properties, something like 80% of them were less than 10% down.
Right.
So when the market falls out, the first houses that go are the investment properties, because people are going to hold on to their home first.
Of course.
They're going to keep the roof over their head.
Of course.
So that was a big part of it. So now you have to make a down payment.
Right. If you don't have skin in the game.
You have to have some skin in the game.
Right.
Now, typically, you know, a traditional down payment is 20%. So, on a, you know, round numbers, 20%, if you're buying a house for $100,000, 20% is $20,000. And that'll get you out of the mortgage insurance game. Now, there are some opportunities where you could put lower down payments. I mean, FHA, you can put 3.5% down.
Right.
A conforming loan, you can put 5% down. But keep in mind, anything less than a 20% down payment, there's a mortgage insurance factor. Now, and if all you have is 3.5% to put down and you want to be that first-time home buyer or you want to get back in the market, you know, that's a really good opportunity to, you know, become a homeowner for
right.
minimal. But
so
again,
let's break that down a little bit for people. You know, I'm sure a lot of people that are listening know all about this, but, you know, there are some people you forget because you only buy a home a couple times in your life.
That's
so you kind of forget the details. And also people get very emotional, I think, about home buying and about what they can afford and can't afford. And
the most emotional transaction you'll have.
So when you're talking about private mortgage insurance, is that mm-hmm. what it's called? PMI,
mm-hmm.
right?
PMI, right.
You're paying because you've only put you have less than a certain amount of equity in the home.
Correct.
And though, so here's the deal. So if I'm buying a $100,000 home, to use your example, and I don't have the $20,000 because that's the 20% mm-hmm. and that's the PMI cutoff, right?
Right.
and I'm going to do one of these programs where I'm doing the 3.5% or whatever, I'm talking about a couple hundred extra dollars a month in PMI generally, right?
That's correct.
So for a lot of people, coming up with a couple hundred extra dollars a month is much easier than the idea of saving up to $20,000.
That's correct.
So don't get freaked out by that is what I'm saying. Like, so you might have to do that. Like, all right. And then it goes away generally after 5 years or something if the home value goes up and all that, right?
Right. On a conventional loan, once you hit 78% or 80% loan to value, which is a 20% equity stake, the mortgage insurance will fall off. On an FHA loan, it's a little bit different. It'll stay on for much longer, if not the entire length of the loan. That's a new FHA guideline. But again, think, you know, if you do an FHA loan, the value proposition is, number one, is 3.5% down, right? It's much easier to come up with a 3.5% down payment than it is to come up with a 20% down payment.
Sure.
You get a super low interest rate.
Right.
And the guidelines are actually easier to qualify for as far as credit and income to get an FHA loan.
Right.
So that's the value proposition. The downside is that you're going to have to pay mortgage insurance, which is just added to the cost of the house. You have to view that as added interest on the note or on the money that you're buying.
Yeah. So you know what? It just reminded me of something when you were talking, because one of the things you just threw out there in the midst of that was credit score.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't talk about that. And so
right.
That's also something, of course, that gets looked at when you're looking to buy a home. They pull your credit score and that affects partly your debt to income ratio mm-hmm. and all that stuff. Right. But I forgot, and I need to bring this up because Elizabeth's not here to call me on it, though I will be calling her on the fact that she's not here. But last week on the show, I was talking about my credit score because I have never checked my credit score. And
uh-oh.
I was talking about the fact that I was a little bit afraid to check my credit score because I tend to be a head-in-the-sand, ostrich-type person.
You know, that's not uncommon. I have lots of clients that come to me and they're a little bit nervous, so I don't know what my score is. And what I tell people is it is what it is. We're going to pull it at some point. You have to know what it is. So it's always, always, always a great idea. Let's get started. Let's rip the Band-Aid off. Let's see what it is, because there are things that we can do. There are actions that you can take to actually improve that score.
Right.
To put you in a better position.
Right. So you should know that, first of all.
You should always know what your score is.
But here's what I said last week. So I have to catch you up on this, Joe.
Okay.
I said, because I really want to know. And the reason I want to know is because I'm thinking about buying a car. And I'm having that same anxiety. Like, I'm looking at all the shiny new cars. I'm going like, well, I don't know if I can get a loan for this, you know, because I'm self-employed and, you know, whatever. So I said, I committed on the show last week that I was going to check my credit score between then and now. And I was going to tell on the air, not the actual score, because I didn't want to be that transparent. But I agreed that I would tell whether it was above average, like meh, fair, but like under the – because 750 is like really good, right?
Right. Above 750 is going to get you the best rate in terms.
So right. So I said I would say if it was above 750 – it was like slightly under, like in a still okay-ish section, or if it was like horrible.
Right.
I agreed to say whether it was in one of those three categories. But first, I had to rip the Band-Aid off and get up the courage to actually check my credit score. So I just want to say I did, in fact, rip off the Band-Aid and check my credit score. And guess what? It's above 750.
Good for you.
Go me.
Excellent.
I know. I'm very proud of myself. I was shocked. You should have seen my face. I think my chin hit the floor. I was like, oh my God, my credit score is really good. I had one late payment on there. It would have been even better. So everything else I had was good, so who knew?
Yeah.
So don't be afraid, I guess is what I'm
right.
saying.
And you know, the thing is, it's funny because when you go through 5 years of downturn in the economy, or recession, or whatever the economists call it, you know, I call it a recession, but you go through that, people get banged up.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you kind of like, wow, I had this issue and I really don't know. My advice would be is to rip the Band-Aid off. Let's take a look at it. Let's see where we are. Because the good thing about credit is that it's always, always, always repairable. Sometimes there's actions that you can take, and sometimes it's just a waiting game.
Yeah.
So knowing what those rules are and those guidelines are is critical. And yep. We do a lot of that for our clients. You know, I get a lot of clients who say, look, I'm looking to buy a house, but I had this issue. Maybe it was a short sale, you know, and there are guidelines for that. You know, the guideline for that is you have to be out of it at least 3 years to get a new house. And that's only 36 months.
Yeah, it's not bad.
And that's a car lease. I mean, that's not that long.
Not to mention the fact that, Joe, at our age, 3 years is like nothing. It goes by like nothing.
The older you get, the faster it
Holy
goes, right?
Holy crap. You know, this is the thing. I'm going to just tell this because, you know, I think it's like a tale of hope for people that I actually am that person. You know, I closed a business in 2008.
Right. A lot of people did.
You know, I had some credit card debt associated with the business. And I had some problems but I took care of it responsibly. But, you know, it definitely affected my credit at the time. You know, that was 2008. It's now 2013. So 5 years have gone by, which was like yesterday. It was like nothing.
Right.
But I also, you know, got after that, I got another job, and then I got laid off. So I had some problems there. You know, and,
you're living in the real world,
right,
which and, most people live in.
And then look, here I am with good credit. Who knew?
750 plus. That's awesome.
Amazing.
A good friend of mine, Sue Wooded, who's a giant in the mortgage industry, she always says the best time to plant a tree is two times, 20 years ago and today. So what I tell people that may think that they – whether it was a bankruptcy, a foreclosure, a short sale, late payments, maybe there's medical bills, whatever it may be, whatever the issue you have on your credit is, today is always the best day to start fixing it. Because if you do nothing in 3 years when you look at it, well, then you'll have to deal with it then.
Right.
So you might as well start now because you have time on your side. And again, like I said earlier, it is always, always fixable. It's just a matter of what to do, how to do it, and how much time it's going to take.
But I love that advice because you're right. I mean, if you're like me and you tend to want to put your head in the sand, that can come back and bite you because then you think 3 years later, you do raise your head and say, okay, I want to buy a house now. Well, no, you should have been doing something about this 3 years ago. And that time probably helped you in terms of credit score. But maybe there were some other things you could have been
very
doing.
Inexpensive or cost nothing things that you can do to fix your credit.
Yeah. So let's talk about picking a mortgage broker and picking a real estate agent. And because once again, like you're driving around with your boyfriend, girlfriend, spouse, kids, whatever, and you're walking into these sexy $1 million homes by yourself, right?
Right.
And you haven't got engaged any professionals in the industry yet. And I think we all know that it's pretty hard to do anything in the real estate industry without engaging professionals.
Correct.
You can go buy a house, but there's going to be an agent on the seller side. I mean, and rarely does a real estate transaction happen without at least three or four professionals involved.
Absolutely.
Right? So you've got to pick those people. So here's the thing. I've made a lot of mistakes in that field. Because people, sometimes you use a family friend or you heard from somebody that maybe they liked a certain person or whatever. I think there's more to it, right? I think picking, because these are people that are helping you, as you said, make one of the biggest, most emotional decisions you will ever make.
Right, right.
So how do you find the guy or the girl that's right for you, both as an agent and as a mortgage broker?
You know, that's a really good point. You know, first of all, you want to use somebody who is either a very seasoned professional, or, you know, it could be a rookie, you know, as long as they're working with somebody who's a seasoned professional, to a go-to person.
Right.
You know, my wife, Christine, always uses a line, and I love it. I use it all the time, is, you know, you think it's cheaper not to use a professional. Just wait and see how expensive it is, you know, when you don't use the professional.
Right. We've all had that experience.
Right.
Across industries.
So, you know, you want to look for somebody that's got experience, that knows the market you're looking to buy in. Somebody who's got their boots on the ground. You know, I mean, the internet guys do a great job. But again, it's you want to be able to build a relationship with somebody, especially if you have a little bit of a different situation. So do your homework.
Yeah.
You know, ask your other referral sources. You know, if you have an attorney, if you have a lawyer, you know, ask them for somebody local that you could actually sit down with who's going to answer the phone when you call.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the number one thing, because buying a home, there are so many moving parts and you're going to have a lot of questions. And look, I get that it's emotional.
Oh, yeah.
I get that it could be a difficult process, and you're going to have those questions. So you want to look for somebody who's, number one's got the knowledge, number two's got the experience, and number three has access to the products that you need.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to, you know, one guy that only has one product, well, that's not what you're really looking for.
Well, talk about that. That's an interesting point. And we're getting a little short on time, but I want to talk about that because there are different kinds of people you can go to in that way for mortgages, right? So first of all, for agents, you're right. I mean, there are some agents that know a part of town really well.
Right.
And that's the part of town they focus on. And there are other agents that sort of have lived in Atlanta maybe their whole lives and know the whole area and sort of know what's good. So first of all, you have to do your own homework a little bit and know kind of at least generally what you're looking for. But also you do want to find an agent that's specializing in the one or two areas that you like. But for a mortgage broker, right, like you can go to a guy that, like you can go to a bank. Like you could, you know.
Yeah, let me give you the rundown of what your options are.
Yeah.
You know, when you're looking for a mortgage, there's basically three places you can go. You can go to your bank. You can go to a mortgage broker or you can go to a mortgage lender. Now, let me explain what the differences are. A bank, when you walk in, you go to, you call your bank up, they're going to offer you the mortgage product that the bank has, and they set the rate for that product.
Right, so that's one product.
That's what they're going to sell. And right. whether it's FHA, conforming, you know, they probably have three or four different sources, which is probably a good menu of products. Now, if you go to a – now, what happens is when you go to a bank, you know, they originate, they underwrite it, they fund it right there at the bank. Now, when you go to a broker has – you know, they may have 15, 20, 30 lenders, other banks that they send the loan to. So you walk in, they take the loan application, and then they send your package out to the bank for underwriting and funding and approval.
Right.
Right, which in that case, they may be able to offer you different products or even more competitive rates and terms, but what you're going to lose is a little bit of the service. A mortgage lender – is what we are at Anchor Funding, and we basically are a full-service mortgage lender. What, you know, what does full-service mortgage lending mean to the regular guy? What that means is that we will originate your loan, process it, put it through underwriting and approval, close it, and fund it just like a bank would under our same roof. Our headquarters is out in Norcross, Georgia. Just like a bank would, so we're mortgage bankers. We actually bank the loan. But where we're different from a bank is that, like a broker, we have access to all the other banks' products and programs, terms, and rates, so we can be much more flexible while still maintaining a high level of service.
Interesting.
Because we control the process. So a mortgage lender is really probably it's a hybrid, but it's probably the best of both worlds. Not to knock mortgage, you know, banks. Got lots of friends that great people work with banks, and
sure.
And I was a mortgage broker for many, many years. So
they all have their advantages and disadvantages. But I mean, it's interesting because I think probably the average bear, again, you know, most people buy homes a couple of times in their lives. So whatever you learned the first time, you've probably forgotten about,
right.
Or things have changed.
And what we're seeing in the market, especially in the metro Atlanta market, is that people would go to the internet. Well, the guy on the other side of the phone, he's only got one or two products that he's going to sell you. And if he can't fit you in the box, he's on to the next one, because that's their model.
So that's a good point. And that's that whole, like, again, with if I'm coming to you and I might have a ding on my credit or something that's not quite right, you know, you might be able to shop around and still find a product that'll work for me.
Right. We're always going to do that. But what we're going to do first and foremost is we're going to come up with a mortgage plan. And that's where we're a little bit different. That's why you want to use a mortgage planning specialist, certified mortgage planning specialist or mortgage coach. That's somebody that's trained like a financial planner that's going to sit down with you and say, here are your options. Here's option A, here's option B, here's option C. Here's the benefits and drawbacks of each option. And let's tailor a mortgage strategy that's best for your financial situation.
All right. So this might be a weird question, but everything about this show is weird. So why not? What is the percentage of people that come to you that you cannot help? Does that ever happen?
Oh, yeah, sure. Again, there's always – we can always help everybody. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to give you a loan today, but, you know, we could always point you in the right direction.
Okay.
So, you know, the percentage of when we actually take a loan app that we actually close for approvals is probably upwards of 95%. Because once we get to the application point, we already know whether or not you're going to be approved.
Okay.
The only thing that really at that point that can kick it out is, you know, the property doesn't appraise or, you know, something comes up unexpectedly.
Okay. So now getting back to you, you mentioned checking your credit scores for people. Now, if you check it, does that a ding on my credit?
Great, great question. Here's what happens in the world of credit scores. If you're shopping for a mortgage and you come to, you know, bank A and they pull your credit, and then you go online and banks B and C and D, and you have four mortgage bankers or mortgage companies pull your credit, it doesn't really affect your score. It basically counts as one pull within a 30-day period. So you could have unlimited pulls on your credit within a 30-day period if it's within the same industry.
Okay.
Right now,
so like if I'm looking for a car four times.
Right. If you're looking for a car dealers. And they pulled you, you went to four different car dealers and they pulled your credit, it's basically one ding.
Okay.
If you will. But here's where you get banged up. If you go to a mortgage company, then you go to a car dealership, then you go to Best Buy, then you get, once you cross industries within a short period of time, that could start negatively affecting your score.
Interesting.
Absolutely.
Interesting. So am I better off pulling it myself and ripping that Band-Aid off myself? Because then I don't get a ding at all, right?
Absolutely. There's a lot of sources out there for free credit reports. You know, the law is they have to give you your score at least once a year, and there's other services that you can pay for. They get updates and all that. You know, I highly recommend that you know what your score is at some point.
Yeah.
You know, maybe once a year, pull it once every 2 years. I mean, at least know where you're at, know what's on there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, before we close out, I want to make sure, because now everyone knows and loves you, Joe the Mortgage Guy, how they can get in touch with you if they need some help in this department.
Oh, great. Please call me on my direct line. It's area code 404-375-0779. You can find me on the internet. Just go to joetrovato.com, J-O-E-T-R-O-V-A-T-O is our website. Or you can look us up at Anchor Funding Corporation. We're headquartered in Norcross, Georgia.
All right. Yeah. Everybody got that? Did everybody get a pen? It'll be on the website, too.
Joe Trovato, the Mortgage Guy at Anchor Funding Corp.
That's right. I love it. All right. Well, very good information. I think we could probably talk for days about some of this stuff, because once you start digging into any one little aspect of it, it opens up a whole other can of worms for people. So plus there's new – are there new products and things all the time in terms of mortgages?
Well, there's always strategies. Like, for instance, we're in a little bit of a seller's market right now, which in a seller's market, typically they're less – likely to, you know, pay closing costs. So there's strategies that you can use, like lender paid closing costs, which nobody really knows about, which is a strategy that's been around forever, where the lender will actually pay the closing costs in lieu of the borrower accepting a slightly higher interest rate. Now, slightly higher interest rate usually sounds like, well, that's crazy, why would I do that? But if you don't have the extra $5,000 or $6,000, well, then it's a great strategy for you.
Yeah.
So programs come and go, but strategies usually ebb and flow with what's going on in the market.
Right.
So that's why you need a professional, because they'll know how to structure your loan the best way for today's market. I mean, there's lots of different strategies to use.
Well, I know, and you and I talked, I think last time we met, about whether it's a buyer's market or a seller's market. So I feel like we could probably have you on a regular basis just to talk about some of these things, because I know there's not a person I have come across that isn't at least somewhat interested in what's happening with real estate.
I just want to make one last point about the seller's market, buyer's market. Even though it's deemed a seller's market, it's still a humongous opportunity for buyers. So it's still a very much buyer's market, just because of low interest rates and low price of housing and the affordability factor. So don't get scared by the term seller's market. Now is probably the greatest time to buy a home. I keep telling everybody, right now, with the good old days, 5-6 years from now, we're going to look back and say, wow, you know, 2013, those were the good old days.
Right. Or that you're going to be going shoulda, coulda, woulda.
Right.
Right. So, all right. Well, that is about all we have time for. So thanks to Joe Trovato, the Mortgage Guy, for being here with me. Thank you
awesome.
So much, Joe. And please get in touch with him if you need help, because he will take care of you. I also want to thank, of course, our sponsor, World Trade Center Atlanta. Learn more about them by visiting their website, WTCAtlanta.com. I'm Dana Barrett. For myself and my missing co-host Elizabeth Gordon, you've been listening to Business Radio X, a proud 2013 member of Central Atlanta Progress. Learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at atlantadowntown.com. And be sure to stay tuned for more great programming coming up here on businessradiox.com.